Don't Speak from No Doubt here on BBC Radio Suffolk. I'm Johnny Wright. Wednesday afternoon, it's 25 past three, and it's time to do this.
On the sofa. BBC
Radio Suffolk. Time to pull up the sofa, and today Kevin Thorne is my sofa guest. He's the chair of the Suffolk Beekeeping Association. Along with his 6 million bees, he also has 14 koi carp, 5 chickens and Jojo the cat. Over the years, he's worked in banking, has spent a lot of time in Thailand, becoming chair of the Anglo-Thai Society, and more recently worked in this area as commercial director for Suffolk and Essex, looking after SMEs. Along with all that, he used to play American football. Welcome to the programme, Kevin. Kevin?
Good afternoon.
There's a lot to get through. So I don't know how we're going to get through it in half an hour, but it's lovely to have you here in the programme today. You are the chair of Suffolk Beekeeping Association. Tell us more about this.
Well, Suffolk Beekeepers, there's about 800 members across Suffolk, split into 6 branches. And we're really all about educating beekeepers and the public about the importance of honeybees.
Because they are really important, aren't they?
Absolutely. You'd be surprised. I think about over a third of all our crops are pollinated by bees. And if they pollinate trees and fruits predominantly, but if they didn't pollinate trees, you know, it would result in desertification of the earth, and then there'd be nothing to eat.
It really puts into perspective when you think of it like
absolutely.
That. And how long have you been doing beekeeping for?
I've been keeping bees for 11 years now.
And 6 million of them?
Yes.
I asked you before we came on air, have you counted them?
Not as such, no. But I've got about 120 colonies, and there's about 50,000 in each. So it's a bit of an approximation. So there's a few. Some colonies have got maybe up to 100,000, and some have maybe got 10,000.
And tell me about the process of beekeeping. How does it work? So if I thought, well, I'd love to keep a hive of bees, how does it work?
Well, if you're thinking of doing it, the first thing to do is, you know, most of our branches run apiaries where you can go visit and learn a little bit and borrow a bee suit and actually go and look at some bees. Then we run courses across the county on how to become a beekeeper, and then you can get some bees and get started.
And what is the process of getting bees? Do you sort of
you can buy them,
yeah.
Or some people start by collecting a swarm of bees.
Oh, so you find a swarm and sort of
yes.
And how do you go about catching a swarm?
Well, they're relatively, once you know what you're doing, it's relatively straightforward. I mean, it depends on where they land, really. Mm-hmm. When bees swarm, they sort of, they decide to move on because they're overcrowded or the queen's getting old. And leave with the old queen, leaving lots of young queens behind. They go and move a few hundred yards from their nest or hive, and they'll hang from a tree or something, and they'll start looking for somewhere to settle permanently. So when you see a swarm of bees, you usually see them in what we call a bivouac, which is them sort of like in a mini camp waiting to move on. And they actually decide where to move because they send out lots of scout bees. The scout bees come back and they do waggle dances on the outside of this ball of bees, and they recruit other bees to go to look at these sites that they've found. And then when the majority of the bees are all agreed on one site, off they go. So it's kind of like a very democratic and researched thing for them to do, to find the right place for them to settle.
Who knew?
Well, exactly. Exactly.
It's so interesting. So actually, so when you see a swarm of bees, they're looking for a new home.
Yes, and sometimes, you know, they can hang around for 5 minutes. Sometimes they'll hang around for days while they make their mind up.
They are a most amazing creature. And Kevin, why did you get in? How long have you been doing beekeeping, and why did you get?
Yeah,
why did you start?
It was a bit of an accident. So when I was working for HSBC, I went to visit a customer, Darren Lidgley, and Darren ran 3 pubs in Essex, and we went round 3 hours looking at all his pubs and explaining his business to me, And at the end of the tour, he kind of said, "Oh, I forgot to tell you, we keep our own bees, we have our own honey." And I made a throwaway comment of, "Well, that's something I've always fancied doing." And Darren said, "Well, I've got a spare box of bees." And literally it was a box of bees in a cardboard box, not nicely organised in a hive. And I ordered some equipment. And then 2 weeks later, Darren came round with a box of bees to put in my hive. And that's how I started.
That's fantastic.
Not the best way to start, I have to
say.
Not
the best way to start, indeed. But what a way to start. And because there's quite a lot of admin involved in keeping bees, isn't there? There's, in terms of, you know, product of the honey, but also selecting the queens and things like that.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit more about the process of beekeeping.
Yeah. So you know, the beekeeping year kind of like is starting as soon as you get the honey off. I'm currently in the middle of taking honey off at the moment, and once the honey's off, then we start to prepare the bees for winter, which involves treating them for a parasitic mite that they have called varroa. Feeding them ready for the winter, because we have to replace the honey that we've taken. And then during the winter, you're really just taking care of the making sure they've got enough food until they get through to spring. And then from sort of like April, May, you're checking to make sure your colonies are not swarming. If they are looking to swarm, you control that by making them think they've swarmed and split them into two colonies as if they had swarmed.
So just going back, the reason why they swarm is because they're getting, there's too many of them in one hive.
Basically, yeah.
Basically, yeah.
And so you actually move the queen with some of her bees to a new colony, and they think they've swarmed, and they then won't usually swarm. And then you're managing, we have to give them lots of space again so that they don't want to swarm in the first place. You're producing more queens in the summer. Unfortunately, we do lose colonies over the winter and sometimes in the summer. Right now, I've this year, for the first time in 5 years, I've got an outbreak of something called chronic bee paralysis virus, which is something pretty horrific to see.
Do you have to sort of quarantine the bees?
Yes, yeah. So I basically don't move bees between apiaries while I've got an outbreak in that apiary. But it seems I talked to some of the top scientists on the subject, and they don't really understand why it kind of like springs up. It might be an outbreak in Suffolk this year, then nothing for 5 years. Next year it might spring up in Yorkshire.
Yeah.
And there's no apparent. Well, we don't understand it well enough yet.
So why? What happens to bees in the winter?
Well, they don't hibernate as such. They form a tight cluster. So most related insects, like wasps and bumblebees, they all die off round about now, they reproduce and they send out loads of queens, and it's the queens that hibernate over the winter. With honeybees, they keep their one queen over the winter, and they reduce their numbers down to about 10,000, and they just keep themselves warm. They can detach their wings from their wing muscles and just vibrate their wing muscles, and that generates heat. And in order to have that energy, they need honey. So it's like the honey is almost like their oil stores for the winter.
Yeah.
It's not, doesn't give them massive amounts of nutrition. They need pollen for that, but it's really their, you know, central heating system for the winter.
It's just so amazing how they actually work and they live. And we spoke there about one of your apiaries being quite infected, but you know, and often we were talking about how precious bees are for, you know, the survival of us as a race and many other species. But what's the situation with bees at the moment? Are they in a good condition?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit mixed, really. It's kind of like they're doing better now than they have done in many years. In that, about 2010. Since 2010, the number of bees, honeybee colonies and beekeepers has doubled. So that's
really
promising. But on the other hand, we've also got current pests and potential future pests. And one of the things that I think it may affect everybody is that this year DEFRA have dealt with 8 outbreaks of Asian hornet and destroyed nests. And we've actually had a sighting, unconfirmed yet, in Sudbury and Leven Heath in Suffolk. So, you know, I'd ask everybody to keep their eyes peeled for something that looks a little bit bigger than a wasp, a bit smaller than a European hornet, which is predominantly black with yellow legs. It's an Asian hornet.
And do they attack the bees?
They attack all pollinators, so it will be it'll affect all pollinators as well as honeybees. Obviously, honeybees are a great target for them because there's 50,000 of them in one place. Yeah.
And are bees something that are around the world, in every part of the world? Or
that's a very good question. So we've got the honeybee we have here is the European honeybee, but there are 2 subspecies of Asian honeybee. And I can't remember whether, I think the 4th one's in Asia as well, but there are 4 subspecies. There's a giant Asian hornet and a dwarf Asian, there's a giant honeybee and a dwarf honeybee, and then also one called Apis serrana, which all 3 of those are native to Asia.
There's so much to learn about it, and I understand that you're running a project at the moment to reintroduce some of the native British honeybee to an area sort of in Essex.
That's right. So probably about 100 years ago, there was another disease that was thought to have wiped out the British honeybee, called the Isle of Wight disease, and that resulted in a lot of importation of honeybees from all over the world, and mainly across Europe and Africa and the Middle East. But they have found populations in Suffolk, Wales, Scotland, Cornwall, and various a few little places in England. And so a subspecies of the European honeybee that was once thought to be extinct, we're looking to see if we can reintroduce it there. And there's also another sister project at Sandringham, sponsored by the King.
It must be really nice to be part of the project that's trying to reintroduce these honeybees.
Yes, it's not just about that. I mean, we work as a small team. It's teaching beekeepers how to breed queen bees as well. So it's also a learning exercise as well as an environmental exercise.
If someone's listening to this thinking they'd like to find out more about beekeeping or becoming a beekeeper or just bees in general, what can they do? Where can they go?
You can go to the Suffolk Beekeepers Association website. You can go to the British Beekeepers Association website as well.
Fantastic. So that's suffolkbeekeepers.co.uk. Kevin Thorne is the chair of the Suffolk Beekeeping Association. We're going to break for some music now, and when we come back, we're going to find out a little bit more about him. We're in the middle of our sofa guest chat, and my sofa guest today is Kevin Thorne, chair of Suffolk Beekeeping Association. Kevin, we were talking all about beekeeping earlier, and it kind of works well because your wife is you turned it into a business, haven't you?
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah.
So tell us more about the business.
So we have 2 businesses. When I retired early from working for HSBC, I kept bees for a hobby, and I had about 6 colonies. And when you suddenly have the opportunity to have a lot of spare time, obviously you need to think about what you want to do with that time. And I decided, partly because I've been told that you can't make money from bees, that I thought I'll give that a go. And so I turned the 6 colonies into 32 the first year, then into 57, and now usually around 120 colonies producing about 4 tonnes of honey. And then we sell that across Suffolk, but also into Norfolk, into Cambridgeshire and Essex. And then Julie, seeing me... she was at the time area director for HSBC in Norfolk, and she was getting up at 5:30 in the morning to make her way to work. And I was sort of like laying in bed because I didn't need to start very early. And she thought she would quite like not to have to get up at 5:30 in the morning. And so she asked the very sensible question, is there anything I could do? So I suggested, well, you know, I produce a lot of beeswax as a, you know, as a byproduct of producing honey. Why don't you do something with that? So Julie set up Busy Bees Cosmetics and has now developed a range of beeswax cosmetics, furniture polish, and that sort of thing. You know, pet pole lotion, lip balms, and just about to launch some hand cream.
It's amazing. We were talking earlier that, you know, the fascination of beekeeping, you know, has been going on for a millennia, and how, you know, monks would keep bees and the honey would be a byproduct to the wax for
Absolutely.
Candles. But actually, it's like, it's funny how it's flipped itself now. So actually, yes. The wax now is the byproduct of the honey, and you and your wife are taking full advantage of both of it.
Absolutely.
Which
and,
is great.
And we're also even using the propolis that the bees... Bees produce this substance called propolis, which is from tree resin, and they use it to seal up all the bits of the hive to make it windproof and weatherproof. So we collect some of that, and we are using that in our soap products and also in the hand creams.
It's brilliant. And growing up, because you're not from this part of the world, you grew up in, is it York, is that right?
That's right.
In and around York. And did you... So tell me about growing up. Were you always fascinated by animals then, or?
Well, I grew up with a dog, which I think is a good place to start. Fantastic animals, and one day we might be dog owners again.
Yeah,
but it wasn't that. I mean, I actually started having a cat because I was allergic to them, and it seemed to be a good way to overcome an allergy, and it's worked.
Really?
Yeah, but please don't take any medical advice from me. But it's worked for me. So, I've had cats for the last 30 years.
And growing up, you sort of say that you were quite involved with everything when you were at school. So was it Scouts, the Cub Scouts, this, you know,
yes.
Part of the band. And it's quite, you know, you're doing lots of extra things as well on top
yes.
of your work. And, you know, then from there you went on to work, you know, university that you did at the same time as working for the bank,
yes,
whilst doing lots of different projects on the side. Have you always been the type of person that has lots of projects on the go?
Yeah, I think so. I think things have tended to go in about 10-year cycles, really. There's been interests, and I tend to get a bit obsessed with things when I'm involved with them, but fortunately the beekeeping seems to be sticking.
Good. Did you know what you wanted to do when you left school?
I had no idea. I had no idea. I mean, I thought I would go to university, and my mother made me apply for jobs just in case I didn't get the grades. I did get the grades, but in the end, I decided to go work for what was Midland Bank because they were offering a management training program with the opportunity to do a degree level qualification at the same time. So it kind of like ticked more than one box,
yeah. And then you worked in the bank and sort of run banks across the country, really, didn't you?
Yes.
And then you've got this fascination with Thailand. So we send a questionnaire out to all our sofa guests, and we ask you to fill in about little bits about your work and life. And you've been to Thailand how many times? Over 30 times.
Yes.
And spent nearly 2 years there. And then you then joined the Anglo-Thai Society as treasurer, and then became chair. Tell me yes. about Thailand.
Yeah, so again, that came through Midland Bank and the management training programme. We went on these like 2-day courses, and it was groundbreaking at the time, because we're talking about the 1980s, and they were getting us all in a room and actually talking about what we wanted to do with our lives, which nobody had ever done to that point. And we were doing goal setting, and they said, right, pick a goal that you can achieve within 3 months, is challenging and rewarding. And so I thought, well, I'm going to Thailand for the first time in 3 months. I'll learn to speak Thai. So it was a bit random like that. And I got books from a company called Linguaphone, probably not going anymore, and learned enough to be able to order a taxi, order food. And had an amazing time. And because I could speak a little bit of the language, it made Thai people are already fantastically friendly, but it made them even more engaged because I could speak a little bit of their language, and not, at the time, not many people could. And that encouraged me to learn more. It coincided with the time I moved to London, so I was able to go to the Thai temple in Wimbledon, where they did Thai lessons on a Sunday. And then I went to the School of Oriental African Studies, part of the University of London, and ended up doing private tuition to get my language up to proficiency.
I love that that all came out of a goal set by work. Yeah. That's really cool. And how's your Thai today?
It's not too bad. Not too bad.
And what is it about Thailand that you love then? Well, is it because you sort of invested a bit of time into it?
Well, I think it's that. And I think I would imagine that if I'd have chosen it, you know, any language, then it would have been, you know, rewarding to do that. But I mean, I've travelled all over Thailand, and one of my favourite parts of Thailand is Northeast Thailand, mm-hmm. where they speak a dialect of Thai, and the people there have often never met anybody from outside Thailand. They don't speak any English, therefore they're talking to somebody that's not Thai for the first time, and I found that really rewarding.
I bet. And in your role as chair of the Anglo-Thai Society, you came into contact with lots of fascinating people.
Absolutely. I mean, one random meeting was we had a lunch, and I sat down next to this very elderly gentleman, and I was thinking to myself, you know, what will I have in common with this chap? And I had one of the most fascinating 2 hours of my life, because this chap had been in the SOE, which is now MI6, during the war, one of the founder members of the commandos. He'd fought at El Alamein, being parachuted into Yugoslavia and then into Thailand. And in later life, when he became the colonel of the Household Cavalry and led the parade at the Queen's coronation in 1953.
Oh, wow.
So an absolutely fascinating chap, and so I'm told one of the three people that where he knew Ian Fleming, and he was one of the people that Ian Fleming based James Bond upon, apparently, although I've heard lots of people
claim
to be one of the three.
I just love it. I really, really love it. And you know, you've met members of the Thai royal family, ambassadors, MPs, senators, and yeah, that one of the inspirations for James Bond. It's just really interesting. Right, we're going to break for some travel, and then we'll be back very shortly. Johnny Wright and my sofa guest today, Kevin Thorne, chair of Suffolk Beekeeping Association, amongst other things, lots of other things. We were just talking about your connection to Thailand and how it was a goal set to you by your employer. And, you know, looking back, you've had such a rich experience because of these goals being set outside work.
Yes.
Do you think it's something that, you know, employers should really start thinking about and taking on? Because it seems a really good idea.
I think it should be something that everybody does, irrespective of whether employer supports it or not. But yeah, absolutely, employers should do it. But say we were asked to set goals that would be in 3 months, a year, 3 years, 5 years, and also think about things that were going to be tangible, i.e. buy first house or whatever, and intangible, personal development and personal development goals.
Absolutely. Now, you've got plenty of other hobbies that you do alongside your connections with Thailand, your bees, and your latest one is koi carp.
That's right.
Now, I love koi carp. I feel like I don't see them as much as perhaps I did, say, 10, 15 years ago. Is that true, or is that just I'm not going to the right places?
I don't know, really, because it's something I've only been doing for about a year. But there's lots of... the beauty these days is you've got Facebook groups and YouTube, so you see all the other people that are following the same hobby, and I guess the other thing is that people keep their koi carp tucked away in their back garden.
Yes. So
it's not the sort of thing you walk past.
So tell me about the process of keeping koi carps.
Well, that's a good question. So I mean really the thing I'm actually finding keeping koi carp even more difficult than keeping bees.
Really?
Because you're keeping the fish in a sealed, controlled environment, so you're trying to control that environment. And it's kind of like a biochemistry thing, in that there's chemicals going into your pond in rainwater, and the fish are producing waste, and you're trying to remove that waste, either through changing your water or by having, we have plants in our pond which have never looked greener or bigger because of the fish.
Because you don't really think about everything that goes involved of keeping fish and keeping a pond in a happy and healthy ecosystem, do you?
Exactly. So yeah, it's important to keep the fish, you know, if you keep the water good quality, then they're way less likely to have any sort of illness or parasite issues.
And you talk about it being your relaxing hobby.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's I think one of the things I've learnt later in life is that being in the moment is the key to happiness. If you think about all aspects of life, you know, listening to music, reading a book, going to a party, going to the pub, when you're doing those things, you're really in the moment. You're not thinking about the future, you're not thinking about the past. So I think that anybody who can, I mean, beekeeping's like that as well. And yeah, just getting up in the morning and sitting next to the pond, watching the fish do their thing, is the best start to the day you can have.
What colours do you have?
Yeah, all sorts, really. I mean, we started off with some fairly the traditional tea-coloured, sort of like yellowy, goldy brown sort of koi carp. But more recently, we've acquired some more colourful ones. So red, white and gold, mainly.
And do they come quite small, or do they... Or do they come pretty big?
Depends on what you want to do and your budget. So you can buy a fully grown carp that's been bred in Japan for thousands of pounds.
Oh, really?
Or you can do what I did. And you know, I think I've got 14 koi and the total bill for them was under £100.
And then, of course, they will then grow into...
Absolutely, yeah. So the ones we acquired in the first year ago they've probably... quadrupled in weight, yeah.
And it must be something. I mean, how do you keep like birds and things like that away from them? Because that must be a worry.
Well, yeah, we did have at first I didn't have a net and I lost one to a heron strike. And since then, unfortunately, you've got to really keep them netted.
Yeah, I mean, it's, as unaesthetic as that is, that's probably sadly the case. We always ask on this programme to tell us one thing that we might not know about you, and that is that you used to play American football.
That's right.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, so when I was a bit in the mid-80s, I would say, it was Channel 4 just started showing American football every week, and some teams had started up around the UK. And there was actually a league, several leagues running, and my home city of York had a team called the Jorvik Vikings. So it wasn't the sort of thing that, I mean, anybody could join, so it wasn't the sort of thing that you were specifically talented to do, but it was more enthusiasm. But it's nice to be able to say that you played sport for your city. Yeah, there was about 70, 80 of us played in a league at the third tier of the national leagues, and yeah, it was good fun, but it was hard work. And a lot of people who play rugby think that American football is a bit soft because the players wear protection, but I can tell you that wearing the protection doesn't protect you as much as you think, because people are coming at you wearing helmets that are very hard. And you know, they hit harder because they're protected.
Yeah.
And three of our players in the season I played in were injured permanently. So it was tough.
It was indeed. Sadly, we're out of time. But a man of many talents, Kevin Thorne, thank you so much for being my sofa guest today. It's been really interesting. We've got lots more to talk about, so maybe perhaps a return visit soon. But it's been lovely to chat a little bit more to you about keeping bees. It's just such an interesting subject that so many people are interested in and want to find out more, and I don't think I've ever met anyone who's not interested in the world of bees. So thank you for all the work that you do in terms of beekeeping here in the county. Where can people go to find out more about you and your beekeeping?
Well, I've already mentioned the Suffolk website, and I would also you can find out more about our business at Stowe Valley Apiaries. If you Google Stowe Valley Apiaries, I can't remember, I think we're .co.uk and Busy Bees Cosmetics.
Brilliant. Kevin Thorne, thank you very much.